So, Om Shanti, everyone, and welcome to today's wonderful class and presentation. And I'd like to introduce Sister Margot from Australia. Sister Margot's been with Baba for almost 20 years and lives in Sydney. And she is part of the Australian management team for Australia. Sister Margot has a very special place in my heart because she cares for people. She really genuinely cares and loves and looks after people, which is what I believe is the core of our spiritual life. And so today's presentation, Give No Sorrow, Accommodating to a Trauma-Sensitive World, is really about how we can look deeper into ourselves and make sure that all that we are doing in our life is creating joy and happiness. And I've personally seen this presentation, and I know you'll really enjoy it. So Sister Margot will begin, and we'll have some time for question and answers after she finishes her class. And when we do finish the class, we're going to spend 15 minutes having some more meditation for Nirmala Didi. Okay. Om Shanti. So we need to put the lights down, please, so we can see the screen. Thank you.
Om Shanti. So today we're looking at how we can improve our capacity to not give sorrow, and understanding more the context of the world that we're in, and the added sort of need there is for us to really focus on this aspect. I was sitting in Om Shanti Bhavan this morning and meditating on the two pictures of Dadaji on the one hand and Didi Manmohini on the other. And it really struck me that, you know, Daddy's face just really conveys that benevolent, merciful, loveful vision on everyone, which is so critical in, you know, ensuring that we don't give sorrow. And Didi Manmohini, on the other hand, has just that real vision of clarity, purpose in a way, an ability to sort of see into the distance. These are the things that were coming to me from looking at her, and to really sort of be able to discriminate what is needed in a particular context. And this is a really core quality, I think, or power that we need at this time, to really understand what the needs of the time are and what the needs of a particular soul in a particular situation is. And I was thinking that the, you know, how complementary these qualities are, and both are really so, so important in being able to develop our capacity to not give sorrow. So what does Baba say about this? Mainly, I actually did a bit of a Merli search because I had the impression that Baba talks a lot about not taking sorrow, but not so much about not giving sorrow, and the search sort of confirmed that. But the things that he did say about it are very powerful. Your business is to remove everyone's sorrow, and if you cause sorrow for anyone, then who would say that you are children of the remover of sorrow and the bestower of happiness? And our role is to be merciful and to uplift those in sorrow. Whereas sometimes we can, through being sort of unaware, or through being in teacher mode rather than merciful soul mode, we can actually add to the sorrow that they are experiencing. So how do we uplift those in sorrow? One other important thing Baba says was, to cause sorrow for others means to cause sorrow for yourself. And that when you cause sorrow for someone, it means you are spoiling your own register. So you're doing two things. You're spoiling, you're adding to their sorrow, and you're also spoiling your own register. So then I was thinking, well, you know, Baba gives us so many methods for not giving sorrow. Yet somehow many of us find ourselves in situations where it still happens. We may feel there's no intention to cause sorrow, but the outcome is that someone has taken sorrow. So what are the many methods that Baba gives us? Some of them, all of these things add to our capacity to not give sorrow. If we are really pure in thought, intention, action, vision on the other and so on, if we have that pure soul conscious vision, if we're in remembrance of Baba, if we have a benevolent and merciful attitude, if we stop and feel the pulse before responding, so that we can target our response to that pulse that we are feeling, speaking softly and sweetly, because often when we are causing sorrow, maybe our voice is raised, maybe we're angry, maybe we're frustrated, and it will often come out in the quality of our voice. We need respect for others and the harmonising of sanskars. Sister Jandy was talking about this dance of harmonising sanskars, and you know, which really involves that process of assessing the other person as well. So if we're dancing with someone and they lead with one foot, we might have been expecting the other one, but they lead with you know, they surprise us. We have to be able to respond to that. We have to adapt, and we have to move smoothly. So this is just a sort of a nice, I suppose, analogy for what it takes when dealing with other souls. We also, but you know, although we know all these things, we're not perfect, right? So we're still going to make mistakes. We're still going to unintentionally hurt. On top of that, we've been talking more about what's happening in wider society. There's a real sense of increasing disasters, an increase in violence, trauma, bullying, abusive relationships. All of these things seem to be on the rise. There's misuse of power evident in all aspects of life, whether it's business, politics, religion, community organisations, and so on. And of course, within religious groups, within spiritual groups, there's the potential for spiritual abuse. And what do we mean by that? Spiritual abuse is any misuse. Someone who has a position in a spiritual organisation has a certain maybe unacknowledged power, but whoever comes to them is coming to a person they see as should be a person of integrity, a person above misusing the power of their position, and that there's an imbalance. So whether it's a teacher with a student, a leader with a follower, a older person versus a younger person, male versus female, and so on. All of these sort of characteristics can bring a sense of an imbalance in the power ratio. And so if someone comes to a spiritual leader or a spiritual teacher, they're coming often from a place of some vulnerability and seeking something that they feel that they don't have. So there's sort of there's a dependency in that sort of relationship. And, you know, over the last 10 years, there's been, you know, an explosion of information about all the sorts of abuses that can occur through misuse of power in spiritual organisations. And along with that, a growing awareness and lowering tolerance for any actions by religious or spiritual leaders, teachers and so on that are seen as an abuse of their position or as causing sorrow when they should be doing the opposite of that. Baba says to us, you know, towards the end, do you hear the cries of the people? That increasingly the rates of bad fortune, trauma and so on are increasing, and you know, we have to be sensitive to those cries. And it sort of came to me, you know, what extra knowledge and methods and self-transformation do we need in order to be better able to handle that? And why is it increasingly important now? How, and particularly how might we draw on science and research to increase our capacity to uplift those in distress and be sensitive to those experiencing trauma? Because there's a very specific body of knowledge now which has been well researched about the whole concept of trauma and you know, what is helpful in your interactions with people who've been suffering trauma, or if you happen to go into situations. You know, many people from spiritual groups offer support, for instance, after disasters. It's important to know what sort of support is going to be most useful in that context. So firstly, just, you know, if you are faced with anyone who is suffering, what do we have to offer? The most important thing when people are suffering is to offer them a safe haven. When people are suffering, they've experienced some sort of shock or situation where their world has been turned upside down in some way, when, you know, what they thought they could take for granted is taken away from them. So there's a loss of control, there's a loss of sense of stability, there's a loss of safety of what is known. So the sort of atmosphere that our BK centres offer really match the needs often. So, you know, they provide a sense of stability, calm, peace and positive. And we have to also emanate that whatever situation we're in, if we're in interaction in those contexts, that our responses have to be ones of offering comfort and soothing through voice, gestures, comforting touch if that's appropriate, though it's not always, and offering some hope, not false hope, but through positivity, trying to find some resource of hope for them. And listening, as Brahmins, there's very strong sanskar in Brahmins of teaching, giving Baba's knowledge, sort of giving advice, telling people what to do. And in this sort of situation, that's often not what is most needed to start with. Often people who are suffering, they really need to tell what's going on for them and to feel heard and understood. So listening and demonstrating understanding through thoughts, words and actions, and then helping them to develop the powers to tolerate and face the source of suffering. You know, one of the reactions of sort of shock and traumatic events is that people lose the capacity for a period of time to really face or understand even what has happened. I remember once my father-in-law died in hospital, and it was such a shock to his wife. You know, he'd gone in for what appeared to be a fairly routine surgery, and something went wrong, and over a number of days he progressively deteriorated and passed away. And my mother-in-law was in such a state of shock that she lost all memory of him being in the hospital, of having been told that he'd died, and kept asking over and over again, where is he, why isn't he here, and so on. And, you know, that's just one example, you know, and that's, I mean, it's a big shock, but it's a single discrete shock. But many people have suffered much more complex and prolonged shocks and so on. So you can understand that the impact of that and their ability to really ground themselves in the reality of what's happening can be temporarily and sometimes long term really disrupted. So, one of the things that we're trying to do is help them to face in a gentle way what's actually happened. And this might be through gently reminding them, yes, you know, it's so hard to believe that this has happened, but, and to sort of naming it repeatedly often to allow them to really start to absorb the information in a grounded way, and helping them learn to tolerate it through the way that we interact with them, the way that we support them, the way that we care for them, and to offer that sort of safe haven, that gentle support and facing of the situation until they can come to terms with managing that, you know, in a better way. So showing compassion, care, concern and upliftment is so important, and offering that practical help for immediate needs when it's feasible to do so. So it might be taking, you know, offering them, you know, to stay with you, for instance, or, you know, in the case, in the example that I gave, we ended up deciding that we would take her back to the hospital and, you know, visit the place where she had seen him and so on, and, you know, gently try and help her come to terms with understanding that. And that did largely work, you know, it helped in the process. But, you know, there are lots of important considerations, like you have to feel the pulse. I think in the first instance we actually called the doctor, and he helped her, give her a, something to help her sleep the night so that she had a bit of rest and respite. And then we went back and we talked to the doctor again and so on, and she was able to gradually come to terms with that. Of course, there are much more complex situations, but if it's within your means to do so, practical help is often more valuable at this point in the process than you know, any sort of teaching or spiritual, normal spiritual practices and so on. Helping them see their specialties, their strengths, and to develop hope is important. And helping them find, rather than telling them what to do, helping them to find their own coping methods, you know, and giving them choices is really important. What, you know, what do you most need at this point? What would you like to do? We could do this or that, or is there something else you'd like to do? But really giving people choice, tapping into their, so you could combine an understanding of their specialties and the ways that they cope, and helping them, you know, develop in small ways that ability to cope a little bit better. And when they're more settled and in a better place, you can consider the longer term needs and the sort of spiritual care that they may need from that. So what not to do when people are suffering? The first thing I would say is don't tell them it's their karma. This is not the time to go into a lesson about karma. And it's surprising how often that is what happens. And people really very often are just not able to hear that message at all, and in fact it can be harmful. It can be perceived as blaming, you know, being blamed and judged, what in the West we would call blaming the victim. It lacks a natural empathy, compassion and kindness, and a sense of understanding where this person is at. And literally we know from, you know, from science, from research and so on, that when people are in shock, they are unable to absorb that sort of information and knowledge. You know, someone's given a cancer diagnosis, for instance. We know that after the first, you know, after hearing that, their likelihood of hearing all the following instructions and explanations is very much reduced. So, you know, when you, so it's, you know, it's well established that when you've had a massive shock, your ability to take in information at that point in time is greatly reduced. So you really have to modify, you know, your way of responding as well. And, you know, referring to karma at this time can compound their distress and turn the person away when what they're needing is relief and comfort. And, you know, it's important that you take the time to listen and demonstrate understanding, and a failure to do that can make you look uncaring, not someone that they want to come back to and so on. And I mean, I have a background in both education and psychology, so I'm always interested in trying to understand how we decide what people, or how we understand what people need at different points of time, and what's going to most help them learn, transform, change, and so on. So a well-known sort of theory from psychology is Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and probably many of you have already heard about this. And there are, you know, there are debates about how relevant or evidence-based this is, but it has a lot of intuitive sense. And basically it's saying Our first and most basic needs are physiological needs, so things like water, food, warmth, shelter, and so on. So, and if we don't have those, and you know, if you look developmentally, a baby, you know, in the early stages, they need feeding, they need being wrapped up and kept warm, they need plenty of time for sleep, and they need some comfort, and so on as well. Safety needs are really paramount. If people don't feel safe, it's hard for them to be motivated by higher needs like, you know, spiritual needs and self-esteem needs and so on. Then come the psychological needs and finally the self-fulfillment or self-transcendent sort of needs where we're searching for a higher purpose in life, where you know, looking for spiritual answers and so on. We're looking to transform ourselves and experience you know, the world of the spirit more. Now, these are not sort of mutually exclusive. We can all you know, move backwards and forwards in these sort of needs. You know, when we're really hungry or really thirsty, it's hard for us to focus on any other sort of needs until we satisfy that need. Similarly, if we don't have somewhere safe to be, you know, we can't focus much on other things. So it's important to keep this in mind in targeting how you respond to different people. So if you're someone who's been through a major disaster, you know, we had huge bushfires in Australia, and a lot of people, they lost their home, they lost their livelihood, they lost virtually everything they own. And they really thought that they were going to die too in the fire. So that's it's a pretty cataclysmic sort of trauma situation. And so, what are their first needs? Shelter, water, food. You know, those sort of basic necessities, and you move on from that. So we've become increasingly interested in the concept of psychological trauma. This was first identified after the First World War, when lots of, you know, soldiers came back with what was termed then shell shock, you know, where they were so psychologically traumatised by the experiences they'd had in the war that they often lost the ability to speak, to think clearly, and to function on many levels. And some never overcame that, others needed prolonged periods of care in sort of very peaceful and supportive environments. And, you know, now we recognise that there are, you know, those sorts of massive insults to the body and mind can occur in all sorts of ways. But a trauma basically is a shock to either the body or the spirit. And psychological trauma is an emotional response to a terrible event or threatening experience. And one of the characteristics is that often the cause and one's response to it involves a sense of shame and stigma, which makes it very, you know, so soldiers coming back from war, the horrors that they have seen, the things maybe even that they have done, there's so much shame and guilt and complex emotions around that. And just the sheer horror of it makes it very difficult. So I know, you know, many people who come back from war find it very difficult to talk about what they've experienced. And not being able to talk about it maybe enables them to function to a certain level, but it also cuts them off. You know, it means, you know, they can't be fully engaged in life. So trauma is about, it's not only what happens to you, but it's how you and your nervous system responds to that. So two people can have exactly the same experience, but respond in very different ways. And one may come away traumatized and another not. And, you know, that's to do with sanskaras, personality, prior experiences and so on. There are all sorts of abuses. We're learning much more about the sort of interpersonal, what we call interpersonal abuses which lead to trauma, so childhood abuse, domestic violence, aged abuse, harassment, bullying, coercion, spiritual abuse, and even being a witness of trauma and abuse, or a witness of major disasters and accidents and so on, just seeing the horror of it. You know, after watching some of these horrific incidents on the television, people can feel traumatized, or by, you know, consuming, looking at a lot of the photos of traumatic events can lead to a certain level of trauma. But children in particular are very sensitive to this. You know, if parents are in a lot of conflict, or there's, you know, alcohol problems in the family, there's physical violence, there's a lot of shouting and conflict, all of these which are witnessed by children can be traumatizing to the child. The child can internalize that and cope in certain ways with it, but they sort of carry that with them into adulthood, and you know, it can affect the quality of their relationships later on and their emotional experiences. And there are levels of, there are different types of trauma and levels of severity of it. So acute trauma is a single stressful or dangerous event. You know, so a bushfire incident or a major accident or one experience of violence and so on. Chronic is when there's repeated and prolonged exposure to highly stressful events, things like child abuse and domestic violence and so on, which can go on for years and years and years. And one never knows. There's that sense of, you know, being on anticipating it all the time. One never knows when it's going to erupt. So even when things are calm, you can be hyper-vigilant, on alert, because you don't know if you say a particular thing or you do a particular thing, it might start that up again. Complex trauma is a result of multiple traumatic events. So some people, and I guess war would be a good example of this, or people who've been maybe through many relationships or a number of relationships where this has been the case. You know, it's complex because each experience builds on the other, and each experience diminishes in a way one's capacity to fully adapt to the next one. You know, you get set in certain sorts of survival patterns that help you cope in the short term, but in the long term it may have a negative effect. And vicarious trauma, which is what the witnessing I talked about before, so resulting from close contact with someone who's experienced a traumatic event. The other thing, I won't spend long on this, but it's important to know that trauma is actually now very common. 70% of US adults had faced at least one traumatic event, and 20% of those will develop, or 20% of the population will develop symptoms that meet the criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder, a fairly serious case. And a high proportion of children have experienced what we call adverse childhood experiences. So how is all this relevant to us as BKs and to the sort of services that we offer? I think the first implication is that trauma is very likely to be present in many of the people who come seeking meditation or at some level of it. People don't tend to come when everything's going well in their life. You know, they're in a happy family relationships, they've got a good job, they have lots of friends and, you know, everything's going fine. They may come because they have these self-actualization needs. They want to explore the spiritual realm and so on. But very often, if you think about all the people and where they were when they came, many of them are coming because things are not going well in their world. They've lost their job, the relationship's broken down, you know, all sorts of things. And this means that, you know, it's important as teachers and so on that we're really aware of the state that people come in and the sort of vulnerability. You know, it's like there's a feeling of vulnerability in seeking any sort of help or newness in that situation. And the other important thing is to keep in mind is, you know, we don't think of ourselves as having power. You know, if I sort of raise this with you know, a centre coordinator or something, oh, we don't have power, we don't misuse power and so on. But it's important to recognise that no matter how much you try to be, you know, humble and sweet and not using that power that you have, nevertheless, there is an inherent power imbalance because, you know, you have someone who has knowledge, who has yoga skills and so on, who has something to offer, and you have someone who feels they don't have that and, you know, they may be coming from having the feeling that they've sort of failed at certain aspects of their life or, you know, not understanding why things aren't working out for them and so on. So that's what we would call an inherent power imbalance. It doesn't mean it's actively being used, but it's there and we have to be conscious of it and the dangers inherent in that. And I thought, you know, because many of the people, you know, in the early days, many of the people who came to Baba were relatively, you know, poorly educated women and so on. Now when we look at the sort of people who are coming to many of our centres, they're often well-educated people who, you know, have had experience in Lockit jobs and understand how organisations work and, you know, what the you know, what the laws are and what good corporate behaviour, what good organisational behaviour is and so on. And, you know, there's this whole field of ethics and ethical principles which most people, particularly say in the professions, have been well trained in. And so they may be coming with this sort of lens. So I thought it might be helpful to just think, how does Srimat and so on relate to what people may be coming with in terms of their understanding of ethical principles and so on. So I suppose I position myself as a health professional and educator and so on, and one of the core ethical principles there is do no harm. You mightn't be able to cure everyone, you mightn't be able to turn everyone into a Brahmin, you know, a a fully Paka Brahman. But the first principle is do no harm, which relates to this concept of do not give sorrow. Even if we can't, help people become really happy and so on, at least we don't add to their sorrow. And a duty of care to those we serve is a very core ethical principle as well. And that relates to Baba's sort of call for us to be merciful and benevolent. Acceptance without judgment, being soul conscious, having a soul conscious vision on everyone, and assessing their needs. So, in any sort of service organisation, for instance, the first thing you do is you assess what are the needs in this situation, understand the power imbalance, and meet the needs within within the parameters of a proper sort of relationship there. So maintaining pure and clean boundaries. Stay in your lane, Baba would say, and have that elevated detachment. Another core concept is competence, self-competence. So you only practice and do things within the area that you are competent in. And for Brahmins, this is particularly important, I think, because sometimes, after serving and doing lots of service, we can become worn out. We can begin to neglect our own spiritual and emotional, psychological well-being, and just think we need to do more and more and more. And this can have a toll on the people around us. So we move beyond being, a good hard worker to actually being sort of impaired in the way that we are working, which is not good for us and it's not good for other people around us. And the other thing is honesty, I think, and our capacity to acknowledge when we've made a mistake. Baba's very clear about this. We acknowledge our mistakes, we tell the Father, and we seek to repair a relationship if we have caused sorrow. We don't just sort of tap ourselves on the hand and say, oh, I won't do it again. But if we know that we've caused sorrow or we've created a bit of a rupture in the relationship, we have a sort of a duty to do what we can to repair that. And the sooner we do that, the sooner we sort of clear the slate, so to speak. And now I want to talk about, and so I'm moving much more into thinking about this from an organisational perspective and how we try and ensure that what we're offering fits within, societal norms of the way that we should in terms of the current context. So it's recognised widely that there is an increase in people experiencing trauma, and that many of the ways that services to help people have been set up in the past did not necessarily meet the needs of people with trauma. And I wonder, to what extent that may be true of the way that we offer spiritual services as well. So there's a lot of work that's gone on to what are some of the key principles of trauma-informed care. And we could say, well, it would be good if our centres and so on were also able to be aware of what's good practice to help us ensure that we provide the best possible support for people who may be coming with some experience of trauma, and that we are aware of it. So the first thing, obviously, is being aware of trauma and the signs of trauma and the impact of trauma and how that may affect their learning experience, their ability to meditate. There are lots of implications around, you know, needing, say, very short. So you don't throw someone with a serious trauma experience into a two-hour bhati, for instance, you know, sort of short, very short meditation experiences, and the ability to process it afterwards would be a much safer way to go with that. So awareness of trauma, ensuring that we're promoting safety, helping rebuild control, and the way that we do that is, for instance, through offering choices. And to give a simple example, one of the impacts of trauma is to make people hypervigilant. That means they're on alert. You know, that they've sensed danger and they're on alert and they're looking for any sign of it. And so when you get in a hypervigilant state, it means you're sort of constantly aroused and sort of looking out for possible trouble. So if someone goes into a meditation commentary and says, you know, leave your eyes open or leave your eyes closed, or close, actually closing your eyes can perhaps be more triggering because people might feel more safe to leave their eyes open, or it could be the other way around. But that's a good example of where we can give people choice. So we can say, you know, it's our usual practice to meditate with our eyes open, but if you feel more comfortable to do it with eyes closed, you can do that too. So that you're giving people choice. And there are many ways in the meditation commentaries to think about ways that instead of directing people on how to do everything, you're giving suggestions rather than directions, and you're giving them some alternatives. Another one that might be triggering is, you know, sometimes people say something like, you know, go back to a safe place, you know, when you were a child or something. Well, there may be some people who never felt safe when they were a child. And that can be a triggering thing. So you need to think carefully about the sort of suggestions that you make in a meditation commentary if you know that, or if you sense that there may be people who've experienced a certain level of trauma. Promoting connection. Often when people are traumatized, they get disconnected from their usual sources of support and so on, and promoting connection is important. So ensuring that people talk to them and, you know, have good interactions and so on. Focusing on their strengths and helping them believe in recovery. One of the things about trauma is that people can become a bit hopeless because of the loss of control. The unpredictable nature of what they've experienced, it can seriously damage their capacity to be hopeful for the future. And helping them believe that, you know, some gentle meditation experiences and working through the issues, they can come to a better place. I'm going to jump over those couple. And in terms of the organisation, some of the sorts of policies that we should have as an organisation is really around keeping children safe. And usually in many countries there are guidelines about what a child safe organisation is, and you can just adapt that to to your own needs. But, you know, some of the obvious things coming out of the whole, you know, in Australia, and I know in many other countries, we had a major royal commission into institutional abuse of children in religious organisations, for instance. You know, like the, you know, the Catholic priests issue that was very prominent, prominently exposed in many countries, and so on. So an obvious guideline is, you know, you don't have a single staff, a single person looking after children in unsupervised contexts, and particularly male brothers. But I think it's you know, an important guideline for everyone that, you know, you have at least two people who would be present. And in Australia, we encourage parents to, you know, at least one parent to stay with the children as well if we're putting on any activities for children. There are obviously really important guidelines that need to be around retreat experiences, coming to Mudaban with parents for children's programs and so on. Increasingly, we're being required to have abuse prevention policies. For instance, in Australia, for us to get insurance to cover any possible claims for abuse, we have to show that we have a very robust policy and the processes and methods in place to both sort of prevent but also to deal with any complaints that might be made. So that might be harassment, sexual harassment, bullying, sexual abuse, physical abuse, those sorts of things. I mean, the main things that tend to come up in the Brahmin world are things like bullying or you know, inappropriate, not dealing with grievances appropriately. So also having a good complaints handling process is really important, and a really clear sense of a policy around duty of care, and that, you know, we have an obligation to look after other Brahmins and support them. Because in an organisation, the culture can be such that it is difficult for people to raise issues of dissatisfaction with the way things have happened. And so the policy helps to put it on the agenda, to make everyone aware that there are norms in this organisation that these things won't be tolerated, and that there is a process for dealing, and that people are encouraged to bring it to the attention of the appropriate people if they feel that something inappropriate has happened. And lastly, this sort of comes from coming out of our Royal Commission about abuse by clergy and so on. They look at, it was a very thorough review, and it's quite an interesting document. And they looked at what were the characteristics of organisations where abuse was more likely to occur. And they found that it was more likely in what they called guru-led organisations, where the culture prohibits challenge.
Thank you.
So it's suggesting that organizations need to be open to feedback, to challenge if something is going wrong, and that one of the ways of achieving that is to move away from that sort of guru-led leadership model to a more shared leadership approach, which is obviously what the Yajna has done over a long period of time now. You know, really since Baba left, there has been a model of sharing leadership and, you know, really sort of mutual decision-making through that. And this, by sharing leadership, it fosters a greater sense of transparency and accountability, and it can lead to more development opportunities and better outcomes for others. You know, that was a major aim, for instance, of the movement, I guess, since about the 90s within the Brahmin world, to really open up more opportunities. Baba's been talking about putting others in front and so on a lot more recently and so on. So, the other benefit of doing that is that it can be more supportive for leaders. You know, where you have a single person who's carrying all of the responsibility, that can be, you know, a lot of, I mean, they're doing it with Baba, but even so, you can see that they're more likely to end up feeling burdened and sort of overwhelmed. And then really not, and it's not training up new leaders. Whereas when it's shared, it can be a very sustaining process for the leaders themselves. They learn from each other, they get strength from each other, they are able to draw on their complementary skills. You know, as I started with that model of Dadiji and Didi Manmohini, you know, they had very complementary skills in a way, and that really worked for the Yagya. And, you know, if you look at the way well-functioning teams work, it's, you know, you don't have a whole lot of people who have exactly the same skills and attributes. What makes a good team work is having people with different skills, different ideas, different bodies of knowledge and so on, so that they can all come and work together and create something that is greater than any of them could individually do. And this is very much the model of the Yagya as well. I mean, you know, from Brahma Baba's leadership at the beginning, you know, so much has been created that is beyond what anyone could have accomplished or predicted, and, you know, is a constant sort of wonder. So I've pretty much finished there. I'll just present one resource that was developed in Australia was a series of three meditation commentaries by Carmen Warrington. Some of you may be aware she's produced a lot of meditation commentaries that are available on various websites and so on. But it was a project to support an atmosphere of peace and stillness for people affected by natural and man-made emergencies, and to help people centre and ground themselves and return to a state of calm through gentle music, guided meditation and silence. And there are three up on the website there. It's the Brahma Kumaris Australia website. And the project is called the Sanctuary Experience. This is designed specifically for use. It came about because there were a number of traumatic incidents. There was a sort of a shooting incident in the CBD in Melbourne. There were a number of fire situations and so on. And we were seeing that increasingly there are these events occurring that cause a whole community to have a sense of trauma and to have difficulty coping with the sort of upset and challenge to their perceived world, and that it would be good to offer something for them, not our usual, you know, straight into the course type of thing, but to just give it, like, be a sanctuary, be a safe place where people can come and help restore their sense of calm and peace and stability. And, you know, they're there for you to have a look at and think about, you know, is there any way that you could use those? And there are lots of other commentaries around. I just draw your attention to these because I was aware of them, and they're available on the website for free and so on. So I'll finish up there, I think, and see if anyone has any questions or comments. Otherwise, we could have some more meditation. Anyone? Okay.
I don't know, just to see if she could speak a little more about this trauma when they're very young people or teenagers, you know. Just a little bit more about the impact of trauma when people are young, teenagers.
Look, you know, just as we know with the Alan, the standing of sanskaras and so on, get get recorded in, you know, everything that happens to us is basically recorded and becomes part of our soul history, if you like. There's also, you know, a lot of evidence that our experiences are also recorded in the body in this birth. So when children experience a major trauma, whether it's a major loss, whether it's, you know, witnessing conflict and violence, whether it's an experience of violence themselves, being abused or assaulted, that those things are sort of held inside, and very often they're things that they feel they can't talk about. So it gets sort of trapped inside. It's held really... It's sort of actually held in the body, and it can cause people to they have to learn how to survive in this difficult, particularly when it's an ongoing situation like domestic violence or ongoing experiences themselves, or, you know, having a parent with a mental illness or alcohol and substance abuse problem and so on. These sort of things, they shape the way the person develops, and they activate a sort of survival mechanism. They can activate a sort of survival or coping mechanism within themselves. But very often they don't have anyone they can talk to about it. And it's partly, sometimes they're silenced by parents or others around them. Other times they may just feel a sense of shame or guilt and so on, and don't... they may fear that they won't be believed, or they may feel it's destroying the family unit and so on. There are all sorts of reasons, but they can carry this within them. So when they emerge into adulthood, it can affect the way they form into relationships. It can affect their ways of coping emotionally with certain situations that arise, and so on. You know, and many of their actions may come from that more sort of survival, learnt behaviour, rather than what's healthy and effective in the current situation. So that's, for instance, you know, there are some sort of patterns that you see emerge. So a person who's maybe grown up in a family where there's domestic violence, for instance, may also then, as an adult, unknowingly enter into a relationship that is also becomes violent and so on. And they may even leave that relationship and go into another one, which is maybe, you know, once again abusive, but in a different way or in a similar way. So it's like you are moulded and formed by the experiences you've had. And often to work through that, you need some additional support through counselling, through having someone trusted that you can confide in and so on. And it takes a lot of courage and strength to face. And, you know, I'm personally an advocate of counselling for any, you know, Brahmin who feels that there are any sort of issues or patterns in their life that they're not happy with, and they're finding difficult to transform on their own. I think counselling can be an added resource that can help you work through these things. And my experience is that when you do allow yourself to do that, it's like a sort of a cleaning of the slate that, you know, Baba refers to, and, you know, you can more freely take yourself to Baba and explore your feelings and experiences. You know, we know the ideal is that, you know, Baba should be enough. But for deeply held things that maybe we're only partially aware of ourselves because we've protected ourselves so much, then it could be difficult to take to Baba because we don't really know, you know, we don't have the right words or we don't know how to do it, and we may be fearful of what may emerge. I mean, one of the benefits of counselling is that it enables us to face certain issues that we don't feel quite strong enough to do on our own, because it can be quite, it can be very fearful. You know, it takes a lot of courage to do that, but if it's engaged improperly with a good therapist, you inevitably come out much stronger and clearer, and you know, it can provide, it can add to that experience of being purified and being able to use yoga more effectively to do that for yourself in the future. I don't know if that answers. Is there someone over? Maybe not. Another one here, over here.
Thank you for your presentation. It's really worthwhile, and I think also very important for all of us. But I cannot write so fast, so I just want to ask you if there anything we can read, or, you know, some important points we have to take care of, for, you know, mm-hmm. Is there something you can share with us on paper or digital?
Look, I'm happy to make the presentation available to you, and maybe one of the things I could do is, I don't have something else on hand, but I could put together a few references or things that could be read. If people are really interested, I was just thinking, if people are really interested in the impact of trauma, there are two very good books that have been quite influential in the field. One's called The Body Remembers. The Body Remembers. And another one is called The Body Keeps Score. So similar sort of themes, if you like, but they really go into the evidence, you know, to support what happens in the body and how the body is changed by the experiences of trauma and so on. And it's, you know, when people have these sort of devastating experiences, a tendency can often be to close down. And that's an important survival period for a certain period of time. But after that, it sort of traps you and stops you developing more fully. So it is helpful to understand, you know, if you've been through an experience or have a sense of having unresolved things inside you. And I think, you know, if you feel like you need some extra help, anyone who feels like they need a bit of extra help with it, then, you know, having someone trained to do that with can be a good thing, but also reading some resources. And there's a lot on the internet, you know, there's a lot of, you have to sort of discern what's a good resource, I guess. But there are a lot of resources now, but this whole movement towards trauma-informed, trauma-sensitive, those sort of terminologies, there's lots of guidelines available from, you know, government bodies and health agencies and organisations, if anyone's interested in exploring that a bit more. You know, the basic principles are very accessible, and they're very complementary with Baba's knowledge. You know, being aware, being sensitive, being, you know, meeting the needs of the other and so on. The principles, I think, are very consistent. It's not like it's an alternative approach, but I think adding in the awareness of what trauma is, what it does. You know, I remember I had an experience once. I was spending an extended period of time in a centre in another country, and it was sort of Amrit Vela, and a visitor came in and sat down, and was sort of, you know, they couldn't sit still for even like 2 minutes. You know, they were twitching and moving and big sighs, and, you know, it was really sort of startling to me, you know, that someone would come to Amrit Vela like that, and I found myself having some waste thoughts and so on. And afterwards, you know, part of me knew that, you know, this person is really struggling and so on. But I learned much more about the person's story, and, you know, she had been through massive traumatic experiences and so on, and her whole body was still reacting to all of that. And, you know, and I observed how over the course of a week, you know, it gradually improved every day and so on, and still had a long way to go. Like, it was an extreme sort of level, I guess. But it really, having that knowledge allows you not to jump to judgment. And when you see certain signs of distress, of reactivity, you know, one of the things trauma does is it makes you very reactive. It comes from that hypervigilance, that sense of a threat, something bad could happen at any moment, and so you become very reactive. And there's a whole body of knowledge around how to soothe that, the nervous system, when it gets in that sort of state. And there's a whole concept of self-soothing. You know, one can learn to soothe oneself. You know, some people find it, you know, if you just sort of pat yourself on the heart, or you just stroke your arm, and so, you know, if we're trying to comfort a child, we naturally stroke them on the back, or we'll pat them, or encircle them in our arms and so on. So all the sort of things you would do to comfort a child are also effective, you know, for yourself when, you know, if you find yourself getting in that state. I remember once I was extremely distressed about something, and I went to talk to someone, and I just found myself, this was before I even had this sort of knowledge of the self-soothing stuff and so on, but I just found myself continually bringing my hand up to my heart and almost sort of like just comforting myself in that way. And it was only later I realised, yes, I was really just trying to comfort, you know, like it was difficult to talk about these things, and that's an effective way to help me comfort. Other people might hold, you know, when people get stressed, sometimes you see they sort of close in on themselves and sort of close their body language. It's sort of like they're protecting themselves. And there's a whole area also, someone was asking about resources and so on, of self-compassion. Sarah Eager in London has sort of given a number of courses, and there are some classes, I think, available on the web and so on that too. But the whole area of self-compassion is a really well-researched method of soothing and caring for yourself when you know that you've been through or you have some unresolved issues there. So self-compassion, and the other key word that's worth doing a little bit of Googling on is loving kindness. So self-compassion, loving kindness, self-soothing, and emotional regulation is another term. So how we soothe a activated nervous system. Thank you. I think we'll leave it there, and I'm sure Sister Sona has some to say.
A huge thanks to Margot from everyone, really. This is not an easy topic to talk about, and I think you've done it more than justice, so thank you very much. Margot's background, both her academic and her work background, are what make her so knowledgeable about this topic, and so if anybody needs to know more personally, privately, I'm sure she'd be available to talk to you.